Rockstep Radio, on demand, with Kevin Leach.
We're in the green room for the Gordon Webster gig ahead of Blues Baby Blues in London. It's a bit raucous in here.
It's red, it's not green.
It is a red green room.
But Christmas is coming up, so I guess it's fitting.
That's why they did it, yeah. I think. Oh, look, here he is, the man himself, Gordon Webster.
I jumped in sort of a little bit too soon. Yeah.
Welcome to Rockstar Radio.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
So you're a swing dancer and a jazz pianist, but the piano came first, right?
Absolutely. Actually, I started when I was 4 and a half. My parents are both classical musicians. So it was surrounding me all the time when I was young, and I was age 4 and a half, I think, when I started taking lessons.
Was it jazz music that you got into straight away when you started playing the piano?
No, as a matter of fact, I started with classical music because that's what I was surrounded by with my parents, and I did play by ear as well, so whatever I sort of heard, like nursery rhymes or things on the radio or whatever, from the get-go, I was always trying to reinvent endings to things, even if they were just the simplest, you know, primary book. There was a book called Layla Fletcher Piano. I don't know, it was like an introductory, you know, ABCs of the piano for like tiny tots or whatever.
And you jazzed them up.
I jazzed them up.
Nice.
I couldn't stick to the music. So I got into jazz music when I was about 16 or 17. My brother gave me an Oscar Peterson record, or cassette tape, I guess. That dates me, doesn't it? And then I went down to, I was living in Ottawa at the time where I was born. I went to do a Bachelor of Music in Toronto, at the University of Toronto, and that was kind of an excuse to kind of go down there and be part of the jazz scene. So I was kind of existing down there as a jazz musician and fraternizing with the musicians and with the scene for quite a while until I really discovered it. It was around 2000... Yeah, actually, March 2000 was probably the moment. I met a girl up in Kingston, Ontario at Queen's University who was a swing dancer, and I was playing that gig, and I ended up dating her. I can go on. This is a long story. Stop me anytime.
Tell us the end. Tell us the end. Is that happy
the end? Here we are in the red room.
Yeah. Let's just cut that story short, and we'll ask you at another time, because don't get me wrong, it sounds like a lovely story, but we haven't got long. We need to crack on.
No problem, yeah.
we've got a lot to get through. So, at this stage, were you studying?
Actually, I was in between studies because I went down to New York to do a master's after sort of a six-year hiatus from education. The education continued in the school of reality, but the formal schooling was on hiatus. I took a six-year break from that.
You
yeah.
then went to study jazz piano academically.
Yes. I studied jazz piano academically. I did a Bachelor of Music undergrad program at the University of Toronto from 1993. I took my sweet time doing it, actually, because, you know, unlike American education, Canadian education is subsidized, right? So I took full advantage and hung around as much as I possibly could. They had a really nice pool and some Steinway pianos. And so anyway, so
but
I'm
is,
joking.
Is that a contradiction, though, studying jazz? You know, because...
I'm glad you said that because, I mean, we used to have a saying, actually, and I sort of think it is mostly true. Don't let school get in the way of your education. And the education, true education, really was playing with people, playing in the jam sessions, going and playing jazz clubs, listening. I would say the formal education gives you more tools, and it certainly doesn't dictate your style. I think it kind of gives you the tools more.
So you've got these two skills, musician and dancer, and together they've given you quite a niche, right?
Well, that's really, really flattering because, I mean, the dancer part. I mean, honestly, I'm an amateur dancer at very best. I'm definitely a dancer in the sense that my heart is in it, and I love to do it. And the main thing that I want to say about that is that there was a pivotal moment in my life when I all of a sudden found myself on the other side of the piano. I was on the dance floor actually dancing. And I realized a different way of feeling and hearing music, which was revolutionary. It was right around that time. It was sort of around 2000-ish.
And did you see an opportunity there?
It wasn't immediate that I sort of went, oh, I could play for dancers and make this my living. Like, oh, God, no. I was just kind of there, and, you know, I ended up playing for a few things. And actually, the story goes, Swing Out New Hampshire, which started in 1998, they started to hire, the first live music that they started to hire, besides Peter Davison and Lindy Hop Heaven, which is a great band, had the legendary drummer George Reed, who used to hang out at the Savoy Ballroom back in the day, and he was born in Harlem and all that stuff. But I digress.
That's interesting. So you have learned alongside some of the legendary musicians who actually played at the Savoy, yeah?
George Reed was born in Harlem and was a black man in those times, and definitely was influenced by the Savoy and danced there. I think he maybe tried to wash dishes there in order to kind of hang out there. I don't know if he ever played at the Savoy per se, but he was 80-something, the last gig I ever played with him, and I did play for a lot of Lindy Hoppers, but that's getting ahead of the story. And what I want to say is my inaugural experience playing for dancers was with a guy named Solomon Douglas, who's a band leader and dancer, and he had a band called Corner Pocket, which used to play as a two-piece band, just piano and bass, and they would travel around, and it was kind of his idea to travel around and play for Lindy Hop exchanges, and exchanges were really the thing back then, 99, 2000, 2001. So Swing Out New Hampshire, the camp, hired Solomon Douglas and his band, Corner Pocket, which was Solomon and Chris Arcand, a bass player, and Chris couldn't make it that summer, in the summer of 2001, and I had become a full-on bitten by the Lindy bug, just dancing 7 days a week kind of thing. Really wanted to impress my girlfriend, and that backfired, and she dumped me. And then I ended up playing.
If she could see you now, huh?
Well, we've crossed paths a few times, and I thanked her, for bringing me into it. So anyway, I went to Swing Out New Hampshire and played, and this is the story I'm coming to tell you. So let me finish this. This is crucial.
I'm saying nothing more.
Okay. Solomon and I played we renamed the band Back Pocket, two pianos. Okay. And there were rules at this camp. It was at a place called Camp Walt Whitman, which was a boys' camp or a girls' camp or something like that. And they took over this camp on Labor Day weekend in September. And it's autumn leaves and starting to get cool and all that kind of stuff. You could see your breath outside. And the lake, there's all these sort of like elderly people who live there, and they have bylaws that you kind of have to whisper, and you can't keep people up at night. Well, the dancer, dance culture there, they wanted to have late night with a live band. So, we played with a live band with two pianos, and we had lots of speakers spread around this dusty cabin with about 50 or 60 dancers in it. And they were all shuffling around, and we were playing Night Train, which I played tonight, influenced by Oscar Peterson. It's a Duke Ellington composition, happy-go-lucky local, which some people call Night Train, and Oscar Peterson actually titled his album Night Train after that title song. And that's the version that I'm mostly familiar with. So we're playing this song, which, as you know, has this phrase, ba 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 ba. And this entire room of people, literally, you could not, there was nothing. You could hear a pin drop, nothing going against the grain of this sound. Just an entire consciousness, collective consciousness of like a congregation of 60 people going, boom, zoom, zoom, at the same time. And I just thought, I've never in my life experienced this kind of out-of-body experience, this kind of community, this kind of connection.
And you were making it happen.
I was a conduit for this thing that was happening, yeah. And they were also making it happen because they were playing me like an instrument. And I was playing them, and we were all kind of,
So clearly, and I'm glad I got you for this interview at this time of night, because I can see you're still all giddy.
Absolutely.
Yeah, you're still giddy after the gig, and that's great. When you're up there and you look back at the people dancing, do you sometimes think, I just want to go down there? I mean, where would you rather be?
It's both, but being up there is like playing the instrument, the collective instrument that is hundreds or thousands of dancers. That same feeling that I had at Swing Out New Hampshire in 2001 kind of culminated for me when I made it to Snowball. I started playing with my own band at Snowball in 2010, I believe, or maybe it was 2009, for New Year's Eve. And there were 1,000 dancers or something. And we would create a certain feeling, whether it was kind of a jumpy kind of, kind of thing. And you see this whole room just kind of going together with the same feeling because the dancers are all advanced and they're all just kind of, I mean, advanced isn't the point, but they're dialed in. They feel it the same way you, I mean, a whole room.
They've given up their Christmas for it, so they're committed, yeah?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's after Christmas, but yeah, certainly. Like, certainly people are, you know, coming from far and wide, and this is much more important to them. You know,
I'm going this year. This is my first snowball this year. I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, that's what it's going to be like. Fum, 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 fum. No.
Are you a pianist or a band leader? What are you first and foremost?
Interesting that you should say, because I've recorded quite a few live albums, and there are points in the live albums where you can actually hear me stop playing the piano in order to instigate something, and I definitely consider myself both. I'm definitely playing and trying to influence the band by playing, but I'm also playing, if you will, the instrument that is the collective band. So I sort of think of it as both at the same time, honestly.
And do you feel a lot of personal responsibility? You know, if somebody else doesn't turn up or doesn't perform as you hoped they would, do you take that on your shoulders?
Yeah, I would say so, because responsibility is an interesting way to put it. I mean, it actually is kind of a rush, you know, because you know you have a whole room of dancers kind of depending on you, and the vibe of the room is really kind of resting on your shoulders. I mean, it's not a negative thing ever. It's really kind of a rush that's kind of, you know, a thrill, like, oh, can I pull this off? Can I make it happen? And there are times, you know, where, like, you're trying to do too much and, like, I don't know, you're just tired. Like today, I got off a plane at, you know, 8 o'clock in the morning or something and hadn't really slept, and, you know, I haven't really slept properly since last night, and it's just an ongoing thing, you know. So sometimes it just kind of get a moment where your brain just goes foggy for a second, and it's quite something to sort of keep the focus.
Tell me, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to recreate the sound of the swing era accurately?
what a great question.
Or, you know, for the current generation, or are you trying to put your own modern take on it? Which or both?
It's more the latter. It's more the latter, and I'll say it's both. Definitely, because the analogy that I use is it's language, right? It's a culture and it's language. So we're definitely preserving this. We're definitely taking it and enjoying it and preserving it. But this is actually the reason I kind of smirked when you started, you know, going into the subject.
You were like, oh, that question again.
Well, is because we actually had a really, like, engaging discussion with the Carlings, Ulf Carling, the drummer from the Carling family in Sweden. He was a member of this band, Gentlemen and Gangsters, which we had an epic battle against in the year, I don't know, 2013 maybe? We lost one year and then we won the other year or something, and there was this sort of like quote-unquote rivalry between the bands, you know? But really, we were really like fast friends, and we just would talk at length for the whole night, like for 3 hours after the gig, about these kind of philosophical issues. And their attitude was definitely stated as, you know, they were trying to honor the tradition as closely as it was and recreate it as closely as it was, and they didn't consider themselves, they were so humble that they, you know, didn't consider themselves worthy to be adding anything new, and if something happened that was new or creative, it was to be attributed to this wonderful art form that, and, you know, get as close to the old time. And my argument was, well, you know, I'm definitely, just by my own nature, a synthesizer of different styles and languages and musical expression. And I'm doing it really organically. I'm not trying to play a certain, you know, like I never studied pianists like specifically and you know, did transcriptions of Fats Waller and Oscar Peterson and Art Tatum and all those guys. Although I listened to those guys a ton, and they're super big influences of mine, of course.
Do you think it's difficult because a lot of the old recordings are, you know, are scratchy, and obviously you don't get the same sound as it would have sounded like back in the day. You know, you've got to interpret it to an extent.
Absolutely. Well, I think actually in a way that's influenced like the way I play with respect to the kinds of sounds that I like from the drums, the kind of sounds that I like from the band and the horns in general, and from records. When I do recordings, I try to get a bit of an older sound, not in a contrived way by putting it through some kind of old filter or adding scratchiness. Like, that's kind of cheesy, right? But what I don't aim for is a pristine sound of saying, well, if the guys in the 30s or 20s had had modern technology, it would have sounded like this. That's not my thing. I just don't like it to be too clear because, in my mind, it doesn't blend.
But it does sound very polished. your music, and that's, and I'm saying that as a compliment. I'm saying it as a compliment, and that has benefits for DJs and event organizers, you know, who want, you know, nice, rich sounding music to play at their events. Does that take away the authenticity of the classic sound? Does it even matter?
Well, I don't think it does, and that's my opinion. You know, I would recognize that there are probably some people that would say, oh, I'm like, you know, I'm not, the Gordon isn't the example of the authentic sound of this and that, but I think the essence shines through, and you know, perhaps that's really where it's at. So I don't know if authenticity is, I mean, for me, authenticity isn't the main question. I'm steeped in all of this authentic sound, and I love it so much that the passion, you know, my passion sort of naturally, organically chooses things to put forth in a room full of dancers.
Let's talk about your albums. A few of them have been crowdfunded. That must be quite a nice feeling, is it, that people are willing to put that money forward in advance?
Yeah, absolutely. The Live in Boston, Swing Central, and Gordon Webster Meets Hedy Kate were both crowdfunded. So, yeah, that's certainly a nice feeling. That seems to be the direction things are going. Like, you know, collect a bit of money ahead of time just so you know you're going to, you know, well, get some support. But it's also just kind of a nice format. It involves people's input a little more, you know.
Have you taken the risk yourself in the past?
At the beginning, I was just saving up a bunch of money and kind of putting on the credit card and combination thereof, and then hoping for the best.
So you've done live and studio albums. Which process do you prefer?
It's a difficult thing. They're two different animals, honestly. The studio process does allow for you to kind of nitpick a little more and get things a little cleaner. I really enjoy the sound of the Hedy Kate album because it's a studio album and it's sort of lighter, and the sound quality, I mean, it allowed us to, well, for her voice, it really sort of suited her voice better, you know? For the Jesse Selengut stuff, like Live in Philadelphia, it really kind of like, you know, that's conducive to a live album big time because there's this live energy and it's just, he's very sort of, you know, a strong sounding voice, and Hedy Kate is more subtle.
It's a common complaint from swing dancers that bands play too fast and too long. Now, you don't seem too guilty of that. I mean, what can event organizers do to get the best out of a band? Bands who perhaps aren't so experienced with playing for dancers.
Well, I would say that before you said that last part, I was just going to say the thing that an organizer can do right off the bat is hire a band that cares about dancers, because I think it's really, the onus is on the band. It's not really on the organizer. It's really, it falls on the band to get excited about, you know, getting momentum going. It's about this trajectory. It's not thinking about this one song and saying, this song is the be all and end all, and I'm going to make this song count and be this, you know. Sure, you have to do that, but it's more, what I like to think about is the direction that the set is going, because if you make this song 3.5 minutes, and you make the next song 3.5 minutes, and you make the next song 3.5 minutes, then you've got all these people who are out there dancing who get to switch partners. And then you have momentum, no matter what you're playing. Honestly, it's like a shoe-in, you know what I mean? And that's what...
We should write that on the dressing room walls, shouldn't we, for every
honestly,
swing dance event in the world.
I mean, that's a no-brainer. I mean, if you're a band that's inexperienced playing for dancers, like, the first thing I'd say is, look, just like get every soloist to only take two A sections or whatever, like to take 16 bars. And which is, you know, half a chorus. It won't, or how many counts of eight is that? I'm it's late and I'm...
Keep going. They're going to throw us out in a minute, but let's just keep going until they do.
Sure, yeah.
Tell me, when you're covering a standard, how do you bring something new to that? I mean, do you try and put your personal touch on stuff?
It's impossible not to. My style is my style.
You know, all the versions of some of these songs that have been done, you're doing a new version every time.
Yeah, I'm not basing it on other versions. I'm basing it on I have like all these, you know, this really strong language and really strong intentions that are just kind of like overwhelming, like from all my experience playing for dancers and dancing and listening to music and all sorts of stuff. So it's really hard not to have my own impression of a song, honestly.
Are there any songs that you wouldn't touch that you'd think were sacrilege to try and do?
That's a good question. I've never really thought about that. I mean, we did some crazy stuff. We did a Nirvana cover one time for a swing dance back in 2004, maybe. It was like Smells Like Teen Spirit as a swing dance song. I mean, at a certain point, you're you know, doing something cheesy, but there's a time and a place for everything, honestly.
we're being pretty much dragged out of the venue here.
Happens to me often.
Tell me, what's occupying your time at the moment, Gordon? Is there anything exciting going on?
My son is 17 months old, and I spend a lot of time with him, taking care of him during the week. And
I thought your son was playing the drums this evening. He's a young guy, right?
Oh, the drummer is, he appears young, yeah, he's actually 25.
No way. We're talking about him, and he's sitting opposite us.
He's 26 now.
Wow. Well,
Happy birthday, dude.
Yeah. Well, then I apologize.
That's a short answer of what's occupying my time
right now. Tell me about your son.
My son is just a bundle of joy. I mean, in the truest sense of the word, he just smiles all the time. And actually, I do think he's going to be a drummer at this point. We have all these videos of him, like, just drumming on everything.
Gordon Webster, the room has fallen silent for this final bit. Thank you so much for talking to us on Rockstate Radio, and enjoy the weekend in London for Blues Baby Blues.
Thank you, Kevin.
For more on-demand content from Rockstep Radio, go to rockstepradio.com.